Welcome to Wider Europe, RFERL's newsletter focusing on the key issues concerning the European Union, NATO, and other institutions and their relationships with the Western Balkans and Europe's eastern neighbourhoods. I'm RFERL Europe editor Rickard Joswiak, and this week I'm drilling down on one issue, defence and the EU. The briefing, could the EU become a military superpower? Only 2 weeks after a European Union summit where the bloc's leaders pledged to spend billions on defence in a watershed moment for Europe, they are returning to Brussels for another meeting on March 20th to 21st. This time, the EU's leaders aim to solidify plans for strengthening Europe's defence autonomy amid ongoing doubts about the US commitment to protecting European nations and sustaining military support for Ukraine. In the run-up to the summit, the bloc's foreign ministers on March 17th talked about EU foreign policy chief Kaja Kallas' latest proposal to find money for Kyiv. And on March 19th, the European Commission is set to unveil a white paper on the future of European defence. The paper is expected to come up with ideas on how to create a proper integrated European defence market and to flesh out a proposal made in the European Commission's ReArm Europe plan, where the EU executive would generate up to €800 billion, €872 billion for defence spending, over the next 4 years. As always in Brussels, there are doubts about how credible all this really is. Diplomats I have spoken to agree that it's a good first step, but, as one senior EU official told me, the devil is always in the details, and there are plenty of devils here. Looking closer, it does seem that the 800 billion figure is very ambitious, with lots of big ifs. If, and how quickly, this proposal can be translated into new weapons and ammunition, and if any of those weapons will make it to Ukraine. The facts are clear. The EU Defence Commissioner, Andrius Kubilius, noted in the European Parliament last week that Europe currently has a defence shortfall of at least €500 billion and is lacking thousands of tanks and armoured vehicles. European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, also addressing the Strasbourg Chamber, noted that, on average, EU countries contributed just short of 2% of gross domestic product, GDP, on defence. Washington is pushing for 5%, whereas NATO, according to sources within the military alliance, is toying with the idea of making 3.7% the official target at its official Hague summit in June. Still, even if there is a substantial and rapid increase in defence spending, privately European diplomats say it could take a decade for Europe to carry out major military operations without US help. In Europe at the moment, intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition and reconnaissance are almost all exclusively provided by the United States. Rearming Europe. ReArm Europe aims to address the EU's dependency on the United States by making EU nations increase their defence budgets. But will they? Of the €800 billion von der Leyen is hoping to generate, €650 billion could be raised by relaxing defence spending regulations for EU member states over the next 4 years. This proposal would permit each member state to allocate an additional 1.5% of their GDP toward military expenditures. While this extra fiscal space is welcomed, few believe all capitals will use it. The remaining €150 billion are a loan scheme secured against unused EU budget funds that 20 countries in the bloc, without AAA credit ratings, can use. These loans should finance purchases from European defence producers, although it's not clear if all the components in such equipment need to be from EU countries, or if they could come from non-EU states such as Norway, Switzerland and Turkey. The problem here is that it is still a loan, and many of the countries, notably in southern Europe, that need to increase their defence spending are heavily indebted. Also, some northern EU states are questioning the logic of this proposal, with the Dutch Parliament recently and narrowly passing a non-binding resolution to reject the ReArm Europe plan with the argument that it just gets the bloc into even more debt. Then there is the third part of von der Leyen's proposal, which would allow member states to use for defence the more than €300 billion funds left in the EU budget that normally would go to the bloc's poorer regions for infrastructure investment. The issue here, once again, is that it is voluntary, and that means that while it can't be blocked by Russia-friendly countries such as Hungary and Slovakia, as it doesn't require unanimity, some countries just won't bother unless they're forced. Bonds and bazookas. Then there is Germany. The incoming Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, has promised a real spending bazooka, which includes a proposal that defence spending above 1% of GDP be exempted from the restrictions of Germany's constitutional debt brake. At the moment, the brake limits the structural budget deficit to 0.35% of GDP, except in emergencies. This could unlock a German defence splurge of billions and is something that is generally welcomed in Brussels, not quite so much in other European capitals, where there are fears that Germany will spend most of it on its own domestic firms and create something of an unfair advantage. This could, in turn, potentially trigger renewed calls from southern European states for Brussels to issue joint eurobonds, especially for defence investment. A similar thing was done to combat the continent-wide recession after the coronavirus pandemic. Issuing joint bonds is anathema for most northerners, notably the Netherlands and Germany. But with Berlin clearly indicating that splurging on defence is a must, the proposal may eventually fly. Military mobility and the Danish model. Eurobonds, or defence bonds as they are now being rebranded, are likely to make it into the European Commission's white paper on the future of European defence. But the things to really look out for here are some of the nitty-gritty proposals on military mobility. It may not seem like the most urgent thing, but EU officials are pointing out how important it is to be able to quickly move military equipment from one EU member state to another. As it stands now, that wouldn't be easy. There are no harmonised rules across the bloc on, for example, moving military vehicles from one EU country to another in the event of an emergency. Initiatives such as strengthening bridges, railways and roads to be able to carry heavier military loads are also suggested in the paper. Another aspect likely to be included is the idea to integrate Ukraine's defence market into the EU market as the country slowly but steadily is moving toward membership of the Union. This is seen by many European diplomats as a real win for the EU, as Ukraine now in fact boasts perhaps the continent's most capable army and is ahead of the curve compared to the rest of us on things like military drones, as one EU official familiar with the matter told me. The document will, in this respect, also promote the so-called Danish model of supporting Ukraine. This approach involves EU member states directly procuring defence equipment manufactured in Ukraine or establishing joint ventures with Ukrainian defence companies. The idea of training Ukrainian soldiers in Ukraine and not only in the EU is also being put forward, helping Ukraine. But these plans are all for the future, and the question remains what Brussels can do for Ukraine right now. Kyiv has indicated that it may need as much as 33 billion euros of additional military support this year. With the United States possibly not contributing much to this, the EU needs to find most of that cash urgently. Image large. Some analysts believe that Ukraine now has the continent's most capable army. EU foreign policy chief Kaja Kallas put forward a new plan to EU member states last week, seen by RFERL, which proposes a voluntary scheme that encourages participating states to deliver military support to Ukraine in 2025, with a provisional value of at least 20 billion euros and potentially reaching 40 billion euros pending Ukrainian needs. The text gives a deadline of April 30th for those participating to declare how they plan to meet their respective contributions and states that payments should be committed no later than June 30th to ensure deliveries by the end of this year. The plan says that this money should mainly go to large-caliber artillery ammunition, air defence systems, missiles, drones, fighter jets, and training of Ukrainian troops. It should also support other contributions from member states, for example, sending troops to Ukraine in the event of a peace deal. The paper still suggests that countries should contribute based on their economic weight, meaning gross national income, GNI. This idea has previously angered France, which claims that trackers of military support for Ukraine, such as the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, are wrong, and that Paris does many things in secret and is also willing to send actual boots on the ground in Ukraine to safeguard a potential future ceasefire. Looking ahead. On March 19th, the European Commission will come up with an action plan on how to help the steel industry in the European Union. This would normally not trigger too much interest, but now it's a different story as the United States on March 12th announced that it was slapping a 25% tariff on steel as well as aluminium imports from the bloc. The bloc will roll out countermeasures in April, but the fear is that a full-scale transatlantic trade war will break out, causing severe damage to many sectors of the EU's economy. That's all for this week. Feel free to reach out to me on any of these issues on Twitter at Rikard Joswiak or on email at joswiak@rfrl.org. Until next time, Rikard Joswiak. If you enjoyed this briefing and don't want to miss the next edition, subscribe here.